Ladies and gentlemen, it appears our friends across the pond are once again in a shambles. Liz Truss, the UK Prime Minister, has resigned. That makes their third Prime Minister this year. Lucky for you, your resident newsflash host is an expert in British politics. I'll break it all down for you, get you set up. And yeah, this is actually something a topic that I kind of feel weird talking about a lot of times on the show because it's not really relevant to, you know, American politics, which is much more of our remit, I would say. But this is definitely a crazy situation. You know, it's on the front page of New York Times when I opened it. So, you know, we are going to be talking about it. Liz Truss, wacky Liz Truss and her day caller. Yes, you're going to find out what a day caller means on today's show. It's going to be a lot of fun. She is out. I'll tell you how that happened. Meanwhile, some good news on the new union front. After decades of corrupt anti-democratic rule, the UAW members of the Auto Workers Union, they are finally directly electing their own leaders after decades. Also, Sam Bankman-Fried and other billionaires are pulling out of the Democratic midterm fundraising efforts at the last minute, really leaving the party lacking some of its most serious fundraisers as the going gets tough. How will they respond, and how did it happen? We'll break it down. Also, the Democrats, how they're really just kind of letting it all slip away. Jack Crosby in the Discourse blog has a piece about that. All right, yeah, so we are starting at the top. And normally I like to save, you know, the best stories for a little bit later in the show, but this is actually a case where I think the best story is right up front. Liz Truss is out, and it really has kind of been a wacky few weeks since, really it's been about 44 days, I don't know how many precise weeks that is, since Liz Truss stepped in. So pretty much you got to go all the way back to the resignation of Boris Johnson, as you know, UK politics, particularly Conservative Party politics, the Tory Party is the right-wing party there, the major right-wing party there, probably one of the most successful parties in, you know, definitely European, if not, you know, world political history, in terms of the, at least in the last century, how much, what percentage of the time they've been in power. I think it's something close to like three quarters of it. You're looking at a Tory government. They've been in power for 12 years. They're kind of, they've been on the decline ever since, you know, really kind of poor management of COVID, worst death toll in Europe, all that stuff like that. Boris Johnson is, you know, the kind of very oafish Trump-like figure that everyone kind of knows as the prime minister. He was mayor of London. He got stuck on the zip line. He was very goofy. He really screwed up COVID. And then the worst happened. He got caught drinking. You know, normally, you know, British people normally love drinking, but not when they can't drink. And you are specifically prohibiting them from drinking. That was a big problem. He also had no plan really to deal with the massive cost of living crisis. You know, inflation really got him out of there, as well as a, you know, the kind of straw that broke the camel's back. I love the story because it's just so on the nose, insane, like it's in some sort of like a cartoon. He literally had to resign because of Chris Pincher. So Chris Pincher was the chief deputy whip or something like that. That means he was in charge of, you know, discipline. He was in charge of regulating the members of the Conservative Party who are elected in the parliament. And he was well known for pretty much going up to actually male parliamentary aides and touching them in places that, shall we say, they do not want to be touched. And Boris Johnson, his big thing was to, you know, well, he was quoted saying at the time, you know what they say about Chris, pincher by name, pincher by nature. And then, you know, gave him the job of top discipline chief. And that was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back. When that came out, they're like, okay, this guy, you know, it's just too much. We cannot have him in the party anymore. But, you know, just like Trump, a lot of that core conservative base of, if you know, just think of your just most ghastly middle-aged British dude, that is your average Boris Johnson supporter. When you think of just, you know, when American people think just of the average British person, you know, the real quintessential British guy, it is, you know, you're most likely to be the bloke. The blokes of England are big Boris supporters, just to kind of put it in perspective. So, you know, that waves way to a leadership election. You got Rishi Sunak was the Chancellor of the Exchequer under Boris Johnson, who kind of led the country better than, you know, a lot of people expect. He probably, you know, had a more progressive, he called it furlough scheme, where he pretty much paid 80% of the wages of people who had their, you know, income affected, so they could actually stay in their jobs, rather than the unemployment scheme that Biden and Trump kind of dealt with and the kind of U.S. Security state dealt with. And that was, you know, something that kind of got him a little bit more popularity. He was also a little bit involved with the Partygate scandal. You know, he took some hits, but nothing really that major. He, though, was just not as rabidly right-wing as Liz Truss. Liz Truss won the election, the leadership election, and the really screwed up way it works is for, you know, because conservatives, largest party in the parliament, they have the most number of seats. Whoever's their leader is by default the prime minister, because they have an absolute majority. And now that the, you know, conservatives, their leader resigns, the way a leadership election within a party works is it just goes back to the members of the party, just the specific people who pay a monthly fee to the Conservative Party get to vote on who the next Conservative Party leader is. And, oh, by the way, the next Conservative Party leader just happens to be the next Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. So that is kind of the crazy process there. And those happen to be just, you know, as you can imagine, the most right-wing people in the country. They pick Liz Truss, who pretty much is Margaret Thatcher, you know, 2022 version, which is to say, you know, dumber and just more, you know, yeah, pretty much dumber and just more pathetic in every way. Instead of actually, you know, going through the grind of politics, she was relatively untested, but, you know, really got popular by pretty much the consensus is she had photos taken in the exact same places where Margaret Thatcher had photos taken on diplomatic visits. Like when she went to Russia, she would get, you know, dress up in the exact same outfit Margaret Thatcher had, and then get a bunch of people to take pictures of her and then put it online, literally doing the exact same poses Thatcher would do. It is uncanny. This broad, you know, ends up becoming a prime minister. And she goes on with her chancellor, who's similarly minded, Kwasi Kwarteng, goes on to pretty much literally get rid of the top rate of tax. Pretty much the most Reaganomics, neoliberal, hardcore, just throw all caution to the wind, unfunded tax cuts for the rich, in the midst of a cost of living crisis, there were regulations in the UK and how much the bankers could get paid. They took those off. They were just like, you know what? The political move for us right now is to say, you know what, bankers, get paid as much as you want. You know, mortgages skyrocketed, which is a huge part of the Tory base. And then the pension funds of the country, which is also a huge part of the Tory base, which is old people. The pension funds of the country also almost went bankrupt. The value of the pound collapsed. This is all when they just announced their first policy, which is their economic plan for their time in office, which is called the mini budget. And so that was really a huge hit to their popularity. Their polls went to plummeting, you know, literally probably the most unpopular, probably one of the most unpopular, no, literally the most unpopular the Conservative Party probably has ever been, the most unpopular prime minister in history. There's about 650 seats in the Parliament of the United Kingdom. The Labour Party, the next general election, is protected at the moment. It's almost certainly not going to happen when the next general election happens, because, you know, because of the way British democracy works, the Conservative Party literally is, you know, they get to vote on when they have the next general election, where it happens by default in 2 years, which is not a preferable situation for a lot of people right now, because, you know, they've been just swapping leaders with no democratic consent from the people since 2019. And then that time they've gone through, you know, this is going to be their third prime minister, likely going to be Rishi Sunak, the former chancellor under Boris Johnson. And it has just been an absolute mess of a situation all throughout. So, it's been just hit after hit. She had to fire Kwasi Kwarteng. She had to, you know, have other people resign. She had to just get in a guy who pretty much disagreed with her completely on her policies. And his ideas were, you know, weren't some kind of crazy, you know, sensible ideas. They were, oh, how about let's get rid of the no unfunded tax cuts. How about let's just cut every single government service even more than they've already been cut, which is, by the way, you know, pretty much the main policy of the last 12 years for the Tory government, something called austerity. That was incredibly, you know, influential. So that now seems to be what the course is for the Conservative Party at the moment. But as I was saying, they have about 650 seats in the parliament right now, though. And the Labour Party, the left-wing party, is projected to pick up about nearly 500 of them. So that is just something that's unprecedented. To put it in perspective, they were hovering around, you know, 202, I think, at the last election, which was a bad performance. They had 261 election previous to that. But they hover anywhere from in the 200s. They're about to get 480, 490 seats is what their projections are right now. And that is before, you know, this winter that's supposed to be awful for heating and energy bills there, inflation, the sky high. You know, this next prime minister is not going to be in any kind of easy situation, and it really does seem like the Tories, once they inevitably lose the next general election, probably not by as much as the polls say right now, to be quite honest. You know, it all depends on who they put in as prime minister, because right now, Boris Johnson, who, by the way, just is apparently, we're getting word, he is out vacationing in the Caribbean somewhere. He's gotten on the plane, he's come back, and he wants to be the candidate. That is something that the most party members, I mean, some of them, the more, you know, hard right base, like, you know, the hardcore MAGA people, in British politics terms, or in American politics terms, they want him back, but most people just want to essentially put Rishi Sunak on the throne. Let's see what the New York Times has to say about it. You know, so this is how it's worked. So the rules will require them to have a minimum of 100 nominations, the new candidates from, this is from other people that they've elected. So there's about 300-odd current Tory MPs elected. They got to get 357 Conservative lawmakers in Parliament. If they want to run, they got to get 100 of them to endorse, to sign on. So these, they're hoping, you know, should be two candidates. If two candidates get to the 100 nomination threshold, then they'll duke it out. But if one person, wink, wink, Rishi Sunak gets there, which is, you know, what a lot of people are hoping in the Tory party, then they'll just say, you know what, sorry, Tory members who just gave us literally the worst prime minister in British history. You guys will have to sit this one out, and we're just going to put in Rishi Sunak until we get slaughtered the next time around. Yeah, it's just really, really an absolutely crazy, crazy situation over the last few days. Last night, there was a vote on fracking. This is another, there's been, you know, just the theme of the day is British politics. When you reverse a policy, they call it a U-turn. So this, how many more U-turns will you take, Prime Minister? You know, something like that. It's just like, this is what they, you know, yell at each other in the Houses of Parliament. So there has been a lot of, pretty much every single policy in that original budget that crashed the economy has been overturned by the new chancellor from the other side of the party, who's pretty much now being viewed as the new prime minister. The Politics Joe account is very, very good. They got a lot of they got a lot of good stuff. So this is just some of the moments. We'll go through a little bit of it in between stories here of the best of just 44 days of Liz Truss in office. Here we go. Let's go through this.
Mr. Speaker, I am a fighter and not a quitter. I came into office at a time of great economic and international instability. Families and businesses were worried about how to pay their bills. Putin's illegal war in Ukraine threatens the security of our whole continent, and our country has been held back for too long by low economic growth. I was elected by the Conservative Party with a mandate to change this. We delivered on energy bills and on cutting national insurance. And we set out a vision for a low-tax, high-growth economy that would take advantage of the freedoms of Brexit. I recognise, though, given the situation, I cannot deliver the mandate on which I was elected by the Conservative Party. I have therefore spoken to His Majesty the King to notify him that I am resigning as leader of the Conservative Party.
Will you lead the Conservatives into the next general election?
I will lead the Conservatives into the next general election.
Definitely.
Well, look, yeah. I'm not going to tell you what to do or what to think or how to live your life. I'm not interested in how many two-for-one offers you buy at the supermarket or how you spend your spare time or in virtue signalling. And I also want to thank our outgoing leader, my friend, Boris Johnson. Boris, you got Brexit done. You crushed Jeremy Corbyn. You rolled out the vaccine and you stood up to Vladimir Putin.
This was actually probably one of my favorite moments here. This was the moment after the mini budget was released, and she was on local radio.
Prime Minister.
Good morning.
How are you? How are you doing? Have you slept well?
I have. Thank you very much.
Good.
It's great to be here on Radio Leeds.
I am really glad that you are here as well, because since Friday, since your Chancellor Kwasi Kwarteng's mini budget, the pound has dropped to a record low. The IMF has said that you should reevaluate your policies, and the Bank of England has had to spend £65 billion to prop up the markets because of what they describe as a material risk. Where have you been?
Harry Cole.
Thank you, Prime Minister. Harry Cole from The Sun. You were the one that wanted to cut the 45p rate. You stood on a platform to win the leadership of the Conservative Party on a platform to cut corporation tax. You and the Chancellor, the ex-Chancellor, designed this budget together, in lockstep, we're told, at times in secret, the two of you. He has to go because of the fallout from it. How come you get to stay?
There's another example of just days on days of just absolute savaging of Liz Truss from every angle. And, you know, speaking of, you know, I promise what a day caller is. There's this rumor, this kind of, you know, conspiracy theory, you know, very common with the known depravity of British politics, especially in the sexual arena, that, you know what, I'm just going to say, look up Liz Truss day caller. You know, that's all I'm going to say. All right. Let's move on to our next story and talking about the UAW. So the stakes are high right now at the UAW with two polar opposite visions of unionism up for leadership. On Monday, the ballots were sent to the UAW members for the union's first direct election of top officers. The rank-and-file vote comes because members voted last fall to switch that system instead of having a smaller number of convention delegates elect top leaders. So pretty much having, you know, an electoral college versus popular vote system for their union leadership, which I think, you know, is going to hopefully already lead to some good outcomes. The opportunity to let members decide was ordered by the U.S. Justice Department's monitor installed in 2001 to oversee remedies to the union's blatant corruption. Over the past 5 years, more than a dozen UAW officials have pleaded guilty and gone to jail for embezzlements and other crimes, including two presidents. So President Dennis Williams, for example, got the union to build him a $1.1 million lakeside cabin to ease his retirement. When FBI agents raided six locations in four states, they found wads of cash in President Kerry Jones' garage. Jones and his cronies had a particular fetish for cigars and golf clubs. So pretty much just mafia-style stuff. Very kind of parody of, you know, what people think, you know, the union guys like to do. Golf outings, lavish dinners, villa rentals in Palm Springs, paid for, of course, by the members. Really just awful stuff. And again, you know, if you look at why unions got this way, you know, a big part of it, you know, obviously the economic situation at the time, and what is, and just, you know, complete, you know, really lack of unions to do anything substantive in the economic system, and then slowly, you know, they get taken over just like everyone everywhere else by people who are just really much in it to make money. And hopefully, you know, in the post-Trump era, you know, the shifting of politics where people are, you know, hopefully paying a little bit more attention, only if, because the world's kind of falling apart around them, this stuff will be less and less acceptable in some of our big, you know, supposedly pro-worker institutions. Successors of these disgraced leaders, members of the same administration caucus, still lead the UAW today and are running for re-election. Their opponents are the UAW Members United slate, backed by the Unite All Workers for Democracy organization. UAW's slogan is "No corruption, no concessions, no tears." The union's July convention, UAWD members put forth proposals aimed at building solidarity and strengthening the union's bargaining power, including a commitment to ending multi-tier contracts, organizing the electric vehicle industry, and increasing strike pay, almost all which were defeated or undermined by the administration caucus. So this is someone that just really needs to be, you know, kind of taken out in a big way if we want to have any sort of progress or step in the right direction. With 400,000 working members and 600,000 retirees, the UAW is barely a quarter of the size it was in the 1970s in its heyday, but it remains very important. The UAW pioneered tactical sit-downs, or tactical innovations like the sit-down strike and the novel bargaining demands like the cost of living adjustment, that the, you know, improved conditions for millions of workers, because obviously it was going to be copied by other unions. But the UAW was also the union pioneer in making contract concessions and in jumping to the labor management cooperation programs that have undermined worker power in the 1980s, especially with its big three contracts, but with the others as well. The union set the example that so many disastrously followed and that workers are living with today. So it's going to be very important to watch this down the road. The administration caucus's track record and recent actions suggest that it will not give up power willingly. Its candidates are now are inventing reasons to visit locals, those against election rules and federal law, to use union resources to campaign. But members now can see a real alternative to the administration caucus. This is going to be one of the first times that something like this has been an option for UAW members. So hopefully, you know, it's going to be a big indication of, you know, with the kind of recent losses that the Democrats and kind of left-wing forces broadly have taken, it'll be interesting to see. It's kind of a pulse check of where things are. My name is Spencer Walsh. This is the Spencer Walsh Radio Network. And if you're listening to one of our podcasts, whether it's Newsflash, Hidden History, The Spencer Walsh Show, or something else, ladies and gentlemen, we have one simple request of you. Please be sure to rate us, subscribe to us if you like us, and leave us a comment, because just like all of you, sometimes we need that feedback in our lives, good or bad. We want to hear what you have to say. So please do those steps. Make SWR and content better. And thank you so much for listening. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we are moving on and talking about a very interesting story that kind of caught my eye for a variety of reasons. And it kind of centers around Sam Bankman-Fried. He is a billionaire founder of a crypto exchange website called FTX. And he decided to do a little bit of a foray into politics. And, you know, the good thing is many, you know, liberals are very happy about it because they love to see, you know, a billionaire getting in doing the right thing. Because, you know, when billionaires do the right thing, that is the only way, the only realistic way that we can affect change in, you know, certain people's minds. But anyway, so this founder, Sam Bankman-Fried, he said he'd spend lavishly to elect Democrats in the coming years. And, You know, billionaires are always great people to work with. We can never have any problems with them. And it's always, you know, good and a sign of a healthy society. And something that, you know, even though it may be hard, something that, you know, it's not really worth changing. We just leave it the way it is. But when Sam Bankman-Fried was asked during a podcast earlier this year how much money he might give to political candidates over the upcoming election cycles, he offered an eye-popping ballpark number. The 30-year-old crypto titan guessed that at a minimum he'd put down, quote, north of $100 million, enough cash to make him one of the country's most important donors. Pressed by the host on whether he might spend up to $1 billion, he answered, yeah, I think that's a decent thing to look at. Adding that the number was sort of a soft ceiling on his potential largesse. So, you know, just like, I don't know, was he trying to impress this guy or something? Like, was he, you know, flirting? I don't know. Even if that $1 billion figure sounded pretty unrealistic, the comments still seemed to promise something worth looking into. After all, Bankman-Fried, who founded the Global Crypto Exchange Institute, FTX, is currently worth about $15 billion, according to Bloomberg, and was one of Joe Biden's top financial backers in 2020. And though he did not pledge to fund the Democrats exclusively, he said his top causes included pandemic preparedness and sane governance. So issues, you know, where, you know, liberals are looking at that like, it's got to be us because we did so well. So, yeah, also pandemic preparedness is actually a major focus of philanthropic movements known as effective altruism. That's one of the big ones that supports it, and Bankman-Fried is one of their biggest supporters. So they do have a pretty, they're pretty big coffers within their own, probably large part due to him. But yeah, and the thing about, you know, pandemic preparedness with, you know, all these people is like, what does that even really mean? Like, does that mean, you know, are we going to fight? Like, I just don't even know what it means. It's not even explained, but it just sounds smart when it comes from someone who's like rich from Silicon Valley, or, you know, kind of gives off that kind of Silicon Valley vibe, or, although, you know, he's crypto kind of bro, but I don't even know. It just, you know, it sounds smart, and a lot of people seem to buy it because there is obviously a lot of money behind it. Bankman-Fried got off to a hot start during primary season, too. His project for Our Future PAC laid out $40 million, largely in Democratic races, making it one of the party's biggest individual campaign players. And the thing is, these were Democrat-on-Democrat races. So when he said he'd elect Democrats, I guess, you know, so far, he's kind of right. When the party desperately became low on cash in a number of House races, Politico reported last week that Bankman-Fried had turned off the spigot and was walking back his promises to spend big on the future. That was a dumb quote on my part, Bankman told the publication regarding his suggestion that he may donate $1 billion. He added that at some point when you've given your message to voters, there's just not a whole lot more you can do. For Democrats group, Democratic groups facing a number of tightly contested races that could go either way. It must have felt like a twist of the knife. Bankman-Fried's decision to sit on the sidelines as Election Day approaches is strange. For one thing, it's antithetical to the things the man says he cares about. After spending largely in an intra-Democratic contest where both candidates are far more pro-pandemic preparedness than their eventual Republican proponents, he's walking away at the crucial moment when politicians who don't care about the deadly threat of viruses could win out. So, you know, you're talking about, you know, individual COVID stuff, you know, is that what he's talking about? Or is he talking about pandemics of the future? Is he worried about Republicans' reaction to pandemics? Like, I don't even know, because he didn't talk about it. Because, you know, is it really a serious issue to him? Or is this just actually, you know, what all these people do as a power play to protect the interests of the fact that, oh yeah, he's a billionaire and he cares about that much more than he cares about pandemic preparedness or anything like that. So he spent launching these inter-dem contests where both candidates are, you know, again, going to be more pro-pandemic preparedness. But then when it comes time to actually take down people who were anti-pandemic preparedness, you know, new phone, who dis? But it's more than annoyance for House Democrats who could have really used some Bankman-Fried bucks to kind of help them out in the general election, and even put some of their own campaign money to elevate one of his candidates during primary season. some of their own campaign money to elevate one of his candidates during primary season, almost certainly as a show of good faith in what appeared to be a promising partnership. This was in the Oregon 6th District. They, you know, started the campaign season in earnest by pouring money behind a guy named Carrick Flynn, and someone who was kind of an EA guy running for Congress, effective altruism running for Congress, and he kind of got rinsed. This again, he was also supported by Nancy Pelosi in the House Majority PAC. But, you know, this EA guy, this effective altruism guy, who was supported by not only a billionaire, but by the leader of the House, Speaker Nancy Pelosi. So they, you know, lost, which is, to me, quite hilarious. She is now also struggling to beat out her Republican, the person who won, Andrea Salinas. She's now struggling to beat out her Republican opponent, Mike Erickson, in what should be a safe blue seat, but looks each day more and more like a GOP pickup. Part of the reason Salinas can't break away is because, say it with me, Democrats are short of money because, you know, they didn't, the people with the money didn't like, frankly, the Democrats that won because their money, in at least in rare cases, just didn't get it through or whatever. For example, Congressional Leadership Fund, the super PAC associated with the top House Republican, Kevin McCarthy, who did $220 million this cycle, outpacing Dems by $86 million, leaving aside the money wasted on primary losers. Protect Our Future's disappearing act has left Bankman-Fried's winners in a pinch as well. Francis Cannoli in New York and Michelle Vallejo of Texas, people he supported, are now going to lose probably because they did not get any funds. I guess he's got to go buy some more malaria nets for Africa. But anyway, let's go on to our next story. And our last story today, it is a little column in Discourse Blog by Jack Crosby. For the past few days, there's been a passage of a New York Times article about the midterm elections rattling around in my head. This is what he's writing. I can't stop thinking about it. It's not something particularly new or sensational. It's just a quote here. This is it. It's from Robin Ackerman, a 37-year-old Democrat and mortgage loan officer who lives in Newcastle, Delaware, and is planning to vote Republican because, quote, I'm shifting more towards Republican because I feel like they're more geared towards business. Ms. Ackerman said she 100,000%, sorry, 1,000%, not 100,000, but just 1,000% disagreed with Roe v. Wade's overturning. But that doesn't have a lot to do with my decision. I'm more worried about a lot of other things. If you hear a sound in the distance that sounds like, you know, a burbling whistle, like a pot with a crooked kind of lid rattling around, you know, it means that you, like me, are experiencing the kind of, okay, you know, it's some kind of a, you know, it's just really dumb. This is the point he's trying to make in a very roundabout way. With a tough midterm election 6 weeks away, many Democrats have largely settled on a campaign message, and it's not one that simply emphasizes their accomplishments. It amounts to a stark warning. If Republicans take power, they will establish a dystopia that cripples democracy and eviscerates abortion rights and other freedoms. That is not altogether a bad plan. It's good that Democrats are finally starting to represent the, you know, existential threat of their opponents. But, you know, this is a material world. And also, for most people in this country who aren't, you know, for the fact that, you know, with what you're talking about, for most people in this country, abortion, the abortion issue is very salient. But it's not as salient as a lot of people want it to be. And especially not as salient now that we're seeing more economic shifts. And those shifts are coming apart because, you know, it's not so much the numbers as is the narrative. And the fact that Joe Biden has completely, you know, lost control of Federal Reserve and monetary policy. But, you know, it really does kind of show that this is just not going to be, you know, an issue that is going to be winnable on just abortion or some kind of dystopian Republican message alone. But the Democrats, they are constitutionally incapable of winning on anything other than that. So as long as the Republican Party appears at the moment to be bad enough for the people, that it's going to be scary enough that the Democrats offering absolutely nothing else is preferable to the bad option, the Democrats will win. But they are constitutionally incapable, and they will never, as long as they exist as they currently structure, be able to function any differently, because they just can't do it. They just cannot do it. Bernie Sanders, the 81-year-old standard-bearer for the slightly left of liberal social democracy of the Democratic Party, is planning something of a midterm blitz around more 19 events over 8 different battleground states and supporting candidates over from every office from Congress to mayor. As the New York Times reported today, Sanders is planning to focus his economic message in pitching focus on the economic message in pitching Democrats in 2022. As to assess how his party is doing in selling itself to working class voters, he said, "I think they're doing rather poorly. It rather amazes me to think that we're in a situation right now where I hope to change, which I hope to change that poll after poll, American people look favorably upon the Republicans in terms of economic issues, more favorably upon the Republicans in terms of economic issues than they do of Democrats. That is absurd," he says. And just the fact that they can't make that case and they don't want to make that case really, I think, shows why they're a party, you know, that's not worthy of support. And progressive groups, they're not going to be asked to pick up the funding. They're going to be asked to pick up, you know, when people like Sam Bankman-Fried and, you know, other PACs that the Democratic Party relied on and thought they'd be there for them, like idiots, in the general election to go, you know, be, you know, win against Republicans. No, they only cared about winning against left-wing, you know, primary, you know, anti-Israel candidates, you know, if they're a PAC or, you know, who even knows what with Sam Bankman-Fried. Or, you know, DMFI, you know, they attacked a bunch of left-wing pro-Palestine candidates for the Democratic Party and, you know, got them out of power or, you know, out of a shot of Congress. But now they got nowhere to be found, and progressive groups are going to again have to pick up the slack, again have to make the case for a failing Democratic Party institution. It's not going to do anything. It's not going to change, and they're just going to get rinsed every time. Just the same story we've been seeing so many times. It's just so depressing. All right. We'll be back to talk about it all again on Tuesday, everybody. It's been Newsflash.